As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
I'm Mark Chapman, welcome to the Athletic Football Pod. Adam Crafton will take us inside the Premier League meeting yesterday that ended with clubs deciding to try and carry on playing all scheduled matches over Christmas, despite the continuing COVID outbreaks. We'll also be joined by the Athletic's Phil Hay and Dom Fifield, who cover Leeds and Chelsea respectively, two of the clubs who have been really affected by the chaos that's going on and have made no secret of their displeasure at the current state of play. Since last week's pod, then, we've had nine Premier League fixtures postponed due to COVID outbreaks in a number of teams across the league. The Premier League chairman and owners held a Zoom meeting on Monday afternoon to discuss the situation. It was thought that postponing an entire round of fixtures over Christmas was looking likely. However, the final outcome was to do nothing and just carry on. Adam, why do you think they went with this option?
Probably because there's still insufficient data. Is one reason, to clearly show, I suppose, how serious this current variant is. I think that's one of the reasons, a bit like the reason that the government chose, not to take really, really drastic restrictive measures earlier this week. And also because, when the data is inconclusive, the government, the Premier League, I think, are minded not to go and lose or spend a lot more money, which it will cost them to make this decision. So ultimately, you've had a series of meetings over the last few days where everyone's had a lot of conversations, considered three different options in the case of the Premier League. I think the first one was, do we just pause the Premier League for a few weeks? The second one was, can we eliminate game week 20, which is the fixtures December the 28th to 30th? Or number three, which is, do we just crack on? And try and play as many games as we can. And that's the one they've gone with.
Are they looking, you talk about the data and all of that, are they mainly looking at this from a fan's perspective? Which, of course, is, originally was the very first thing, i.e. transmissions within stadia. Because at the moment, the situation feels different to the first lockdown, second lockdown, because this really at the moment is about players getting it, teams being weakened considerably, and fans being taken for mugs.
Yeah, I basically agree, Mark. I think the problem the Premier League has is they're being unable at the moment to put on games. They're failing to deliver their product. Is their concern fans? They will always say their concern is fans. I think probably the major concern is their staff, their players, keep getting positive tests. It was up to over 90 this past week, which has made so many games just untenable. In terms of the fans, I think fans are being put in a really, really difficult position now over the next few weeks because, I was just looking at, I live in London. I was looking at the data near where I live yesterday compared to where I will be going in Manchester for Christmas. And the cases, the percentage, which it's rising is four times higher in London. So it's, anyone who understands that this is a pandemic that transmits by social mixing can see it's a really bad idea probably to be travelling around the country. But that's exactly what we're going to be asking of football fans over the next few weeks, and we're leaving it in their call to make that decision. And you know, some people will be really happy to have that freedom and make that choice, and other people will feel really anxious about it.
All right, well, first thing, don't you come up here to Manchester spreading that London disease, I tell you. Let's talk it from a Chelsea and Leeds perspective, just to get two clubs here. As I said at the start, you know, they've both been affected by this chaos in very different ways. When you hear what Adam said about the meeting, and it was chairman and owners, do you think, Dom, that all clubs are in alignment here, as in that chairman think the same as managers, think the same as players?
I suspect that there isn't alignment amongst the 20 clubs. There isn't alignment within those clubs as well. I think a lot of different individuals have a lot of different opinions on this, and they'll be motivated in different ways. I mean, it's understandable that head coaches and managers would want some games postponed at the moment because, well, they've been denied their best players, so they're not getting their best teams out on the pitch, and they're not showcasing what they can do. And we all know that the pressures will still apply to managers in particular. You know, if they're not delivering on the pitch, their jobs will come under threat in the new year, whatever happens. I mean, Chelsea's case, Thomas Tuchel was quite vocal around the Wolverhampton Wanderers fixture on Sunday, talking about health and safety, and not he didn't believe that the decision to play that game, with the appeal rejected by the Premier League to have it postponed, he didn't believe that was in the players' best interests, basically. But he wasn't talking just about COVID. He was talking about the implications of COVID as well. I mean, Chelsea had 6 confirmed positive cases on the day of that game. A 7th player, Jorginho, returned positive and negative tests and was arrested as a precaution in the same way that Kai Havertz had been against Everton the previous Thursday night, which I think is probably Chelsea being responsible on that front. But because that denied him 6 first-team players, he argued that meant that N'Golo Kanté, who the sports scientist said could only really make 45 minutes, play 45 minutes of football after one training session and a month out, he ended up playing 90 minutes of football, so he therefore risked muscular injury or a relapse of some kind. Mateo Kovacic had been out for 2 months with a serious hamstring problem and COVID. And the one day after his isolation ended from COVID, he was back in the Chelsea matchday squad and indeed coming on in the second half. Trevor Chalobah had been out for 3 or 4 weeks, and again he played the first 45 minutes of that game. Now,
but Dom, he did have Saul and Barkley on the bench that he could have played, right?
That's the counter argument, and I have a lot of sympathy for that. I think from the outside looking in, given that A, Chelsea have loaned out so many good young players on season-long loans who might otherwise have been around the place, they've taken Saul Niguez, who they clearly have no faith in, really. Although he did actually do quite a good job when he came on in the second half at Wolves, barring one bad mistake. He was on the bench when they could have played him in central midfield instead of N'Golo Kanté. And they could have found a way, with a bit of forward planning and maybe anticipating the worst, they could have had under-23s on that bench instead of just 4 outfield players and 2 goalkeepers. You know, whether that would have done any good or not, whether Tuchel would have been inclined to use any of them is neither here nor there. They could have had more bodies on that bench. And I suspect that if they play their quarterfinal League Cup tie against Brentford on Wednesday, that it will be a team that does include under-23s quite a lot. So I don't think the bubble issue is so much of a problem these days. But does it warp the competition? Does I mean, Tuchel might argue, well, yeah, it does. And it is placing, if he's going to put so much faith in on N'Golo Kanté to play 90 minutes there, then it does risk injury to that player.
It's a very difficult question to answer. He wasn't, as we sometimes say, sending a message with the selection of his bench and the selection of his team. Look, this is what I'm having to do because of the situation.
They were angry, but then I suspect logistics came into it as well. They'd been in Wolverhampton since Saturday night. They'd stayed at a hotel overnight. They'd had the Premier League representative turning up at 8:30 on Sunday morning with a load of lateral flow tests so that they could check that Jorginho, for example, was a whether it was a real positive or a false positive. I don't. It would have taken more planning. And the reality was that Chelsea had 4 days where they kept getting positive tests. And they had, in the course of those 4 days, they travelled on a 3-hour coach journey to Wolverhampton and back again. They had dinner together. So there was always the risk of more cases. When Tuchel addresses the media today at 1:30, it'll be really interesting to see whether or not they have had more cases. I mean, Jorginho's back in training. He's trained, so that clearly was a false negative. He presumably will be available for the game on Wednesday if required. But there was always the risk that they would pick up more cases because they had cases within the camp. So we'll see.
Where are Leeds at the moment, Phil, with all of this?
I was going to say, in what sense, really? There are a lot of issues at Leeds, and it can't be pinned to COVID as a whole. They have, by a mile, the worst list of injuries absences I've ever seen at the club, to the extent that on Saturday, eight of the players would have been Premier League debutants if they'd come on. Archie Gray, who is the grandson of Frank Gray, the great-nephew of Eddie Gray, would have broken the record as Leeds' youngest ever player that Peter Lorimer's held since the 1960s. If he'd come on, he's 15 years old. That's not COVID related, and you know there are major injury problems at Leeds. I think the issue for them at the weekend was that they were watching postponement after postponement in the Premier League, and essentially the Premier League accepting that club after club were compromised by COVID to such an extent that the games couldn't go ahead. And in the absence of any data, and that there isn't really any strict data from the Premier League which tells you exactly how compromised any club actually is, Leeds were left thinking, is anybody else actually in a worse position than us? We don't have major COVID cases. They do have a couple. They didn't actually confirm that Diego Llorente missed the game with COVID on Saturday, but Bielsa was talking about a 10-day absence for him. So once you start to put the pieces together, it seems pretty obvious what's going on there. But they didn't have a wide COVID outbreak, yet they still felt that they were probably in as poor a position in terms of players they were able to call upon as anybody else in the league. And an ally to that is the fact that their vaccination rate, they think, is the best in the division. They're very, very close to 100%, and they will get to 100% among the players and first-team staff. And as somebody at Leeds said to me, there are different rules when it comes to isolation for players who are vaccinated and players who aren't vaccinated. Therefore, there's not a consistent application of postponement protocol, because some clubs will suffer in a bigger way if there's a COVID outbreak. Some clubs like Leeds, where the vaccinations are at a really high rate, should be more protected from it. So, yeah, in terms of COVID, the pressure at the moment is not particularly severe, but I think they are looking at the general situation. And certainly on Saturday, feeling that if there was an argument about who across the league had the least players and was least prepared for a game, it was almost certainly them.
How have they managed to get their vaccination rate so high compared to some other clubs? Do you know?
There's been very little resistance to it from inside the dressing room. There's also a good piece from Henry Winter in the Times this morning, which is talking about the head of medicine and performance at Leeds, Rob Price, and the fact that he lost both of his parents in a very short period of time to COVID. And even prior to that, Price was one of one of the doctors in the Premier League, one of the medical men who was first onto COVID. Leeds had their initial meeting about it in January 2020, which was fully 2 months before the season locked down. And Price, I know, spends a lot of time reading journals and research about COVID to try and prepare for it. He's very well trusted in the dressing room, so the players were happy to take his advice, and he was very clear in saying, you know, you should be taking the vaccine. But also, they were in a fortunate position, I guess, or a good position, where a lot of the senior players wanted to go first with the vaccine and were happy to go first with the vaccine. And because they'd taken it, because they'd had the jabs, it was far easier to kind of spread the message through the dressing room that everybody else should be doing this. So they are well on with first jabs, second jabs, boosters. They will get to 100%. And in terms of COVID, it does put them in a much stronger position. But it also means that they are less prone, I would say, to postponements because of the fact that so many players are vaccinated.
He doesn't fancy being Prime Minister, does he? He sounds great.
They're probably putting quite a few people in the game who'd be better than them. But he'd be one of them. Yeah, certainly.
It's an interesting way of looking at it, Adam, isn't it? That if you have the high vaccination rate as a club, in some ways you might, in Leeds' case, they're probably suffering because of that, actually, when it comes to the postponements.
Yeah, I suppose they're also suffering because, and it's worked for him the past couple of years, so it's harsh to criticise, but they're also suffering because he's chosen to have a really small squad and not add as many players as maybe other managers might have added over the last couple of years. I would also say there might be question marks over what's happening in training for them to pick up this many injuries over, you know, it might be really, really unlucky. And I'm sure they're covering every base in terms of looking at that and seeing what can we adapt to limit injuries at this time. But yeah, there is definitely an issue in terms of some clubs have been far more successful at convincing their players that the vaccine's a good idea than others. I think that there seems to be a pattern in terms of if it's a club that's experienced a level of success and trust with the current manager and his backroom team, or has a long-standing relationship with the medical team there, as in the case of Leeds, or you look at Liverpool where, you know, does everyone in the Liverpool dressing room instinctively, you know, think vaccines are amazing, I'm going to get that? Or is it also a little bit of Jurgen Klopp being a really dominant personality, persuasive personality, charismatic personality that's managed to convince them? I think Wolves was a bit different in that I think the ownership obviously sensed very early, given that they're from the Far East, how serious this pandemic was going to become, and put measures in place early. And then when the vaccine came along, the players, because of their, I suppose, long-standing trust with the board, were able to do that. Maybe there's other clubs that haven't quite got that same culture within a club, and that's, I think, one of the things that's maybe impacting them at the moment.
And also, Dom, and I saw a tweet from Barney Ronnie at the Guardian on this, looking at vaccination rates. I think, you know, latest stats, 16% of Premier League players are unvaccinated. That figure goes up to 25% in the EFL. But that is very similar to 20 to 30-year-olds in England anyhow. I mean, footballers are not, in the main, unusual here compared to the rest of society when it comes to vaccine take-up.
No, we probably forget that. There's clearly a sense that they feel as if they don't need the vaccine, that they can fight off the virus. They're fit and healthy young people, and they don't need to do it. But I don't know. I suspect that, I mean, I don't know whether this has been verified, but the suggestion is that it may well be that unvaccinated players suddenly have to start training on their own from now on, and because they risk, if they do come into contact with somebody who's tested positive, they risk going into isolation for 10 days. And that's, you know, on a purely football level and a business level for these clubs, that is denying those clubs that player for 10 days. Whereas if they'd been fully vaccinated, then, you know, they would have been technically available still for selection if they tested negative. So I wonder whether that becomes, I mean, Jurgen Klopp has been speaking about that, and he was talking in the context of signing players, and how if you sign an unvaccinated player, that there's always the risk that they have to sort of do everything separately, which will detract from team spirit, basically, and unity within the squad. Well, I think we might find that situation happening within existing squads now as well.
They're going to get themselves in a real mess over this, aren't they, to be honest? But the sport is. I mean, you know, if you end up with two different... I mean, if you end up segregating players who are not vaccinated and vaccinated, and they're not alone in this either. I mean, you know, it's happening in the NBA. There's all sorts going on there. There's all sorts going on in the NFL, and Aaron Rodgers at Green Bay has had an awful lot of hoo-ha around him over him saying he isn't going to be vaccinated. This is a wider issue than just football. This is a sport issue.
Yeah, and when you look at, what is it, 84% now, I think have started their vaccination journey, is the way that the Premier League described it yesterday. So that,
like they're on X Factor.
Like they're on X Factor. That was the phrase they used, vaccination journey. So I think that means 16% of Premier League players, and I think it's lower in the EFL, isn't it, based on the numbers the other day, still haven't even had a first jab. And if we're looking, you know, so even if they now embark on that journey, you're looking at a pretty spaced out period before they get to a point where they can do everything together. And that is going to cause a mess, in that inevitably within that 16%, there's going to be some really, really good and famous footballers. And that's going to become a big deal. And the Premier League needs to decide, is if you have a really, really famous footballer who is unvaccinated and that becomes public knowledge, does that actually become a deterrent to those who already believe that being vaxxed is a bad idea, or further inspiration? If you see some of your heroes saying, this isn't the best idea, I'm not prepared to do it, I'm even prepared to not train with my team or get changed separately from my team because I'm so convinced it might not be a good idea. So I think that's the risk that the Premier League have to think about, as well as encouragement, because, you know, they are at 92% for staff and players, which isn't bad. For staff and players, when you look at clubs as institutions, I think that's above what it is for most of society. So I think we have to be slightly careful about not treating footballers as a unique case in this. But clearly, you know, footballers also have access to more medical information than the everyday person. They're being told every day by experts. But I don't know. I think sometimes we also forget footballers don't listen to club medical staff on a daily basis as well. They have their own nutritionist. They have their own recovery staff. They have their own fitness experts that will be telling them one thing and the club staff will be telling them other things.
Well, yeah, although some people have said to me, though, as well, Phil, and this, that club medical staff and physios often give players injections for whatever it may be, and players willingly take it, or sleeping tablets or whatever if they're struggling, or whatever it is. This may be in the past, it may be better now. So, you know, there are people who have the other point of view. At the end of all of this, though, what I would say, Phil, is we don't have any right, do we, to know what a footballer's medical history is? We don't have any right, do we, to know whether? And that's what I feel for them. They are human beings at the end of this, and whichever way they go, as I have discovered, you know, with if you make public comments on vaccinations, you are going to get absolutely piled on one way or the other.
It is difficult. And I was just thinking there as Adam was talking that there is no real narrative around the footballers who don't want the vaccine, because nobody's really speaking about it and nobody's really articulating the reasons for not taking the vaccine. And I understand why not, because you know what the public reaction to that will be. I agree with you about, you know, knowing intrinsically the medical history of individual players. And actually, ethically, you do have an issue in football writing at the moment, which is that it seems unfair to confirm cases of COVID unless, you know, clubs or players confirm them themselves, because it is kind of their private medical data. And it's hard to know where you stand on that, because it has become such a public issue and public topic of conversation. But if you think of certain other illnesses, you would never think of writing about them without somebody's permission, because it's just kind of not the done thing. Adam and I were chatting about something over WhatsApp the other day, which was to say that
this is a bad start to a sentence.
it is about the only way we communicate, isn't it? You have a situation, and I know it's not set in stone because nothing really seems to be set in stone with COVID, but situation where supporters are being asked to provide COVID passports to come into stadiums. So do you have a COVID passport that shows that you've had one jab, two jabs, the booster, whatever else? But you have players who can go into the same stadium having had no boosters, no jabs, no vaccinations at all. And it does seem like there's disparity there. And I get that on the terraces, you're mixing with far more people and there isn't a COVID bubble, and clubs, certainly Leeds are at the moment, but, you know, clubs have been very strict about the COVID bubbles. But it does seem to me to be fairly inconsistent that you can have a scenario where, technically speaking, if you turn up to a ground and they're doing spot checks on COVID passports, you need one to get in. But you can be a player who has not had a vaccine, is not going to take a vaccine, doesn't want to do it, who can go into the same ground and play. But it is wildly complicated. And you're absolutely right about pylons. I think the first player to come out and say they don't want the vaccine and to properly explain why not, we'd have a very hard time with things.
But that depends on your bubble, doesn't it? As in your social media bubble, because there'll be a reaction that you or I might see, which will be really, really critical. Then there's this other social media world where this player will be a hero,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, and I think that's where it's quite an interesting thing in terms of how do you connect with these people who don't want the vaccine? And it's probably that they are consuming information that we aren't even seeing in a lot of cases, and that's being shared on WhatsApp groups or Facebook or whatever. And I think that's one of the things that makes it so complicated.
I think it's probably fair to say, though, that the attitudes within the game, certainly within professional people in the game, would be strongly against them. And that's why I sort of find the resistance a little bit difficult to understand. It, as you were saying, Mark, you know, there is virtually nothing on which players won't take advice from the medical people around them at clubs, because most of them are uber qualified and know about these things. But this seems to be the one area and the one aspect of medical treatment where there is still kind of lingering doubt about it and resistance to actually having it.
Just a final one on this before we talk about the transfer window, just for some light relief. just searching for anything to end the final pod of the year on with the smile on people's faces. Do you think, Dom first, then maybe Adam, that we're recording this on Tuesday morning before the managers and captains meetings? Do you think they'll come out with a different message than the chairman and the chief exec?
I suspect they will express some frustration, but I doubt they will go against their employer's wishes. And I mean, look, some of these guys, I mean, Tuchel amongst them, where would Chelsea fit in these extra games? Chelsea have got the Club World Cup to compete in February as well.
By the way, how can that go ahead? Well, I mean, how can AFCON go ahead as well, actually, to be honest?
Yeah, different questions, but we'll have to see where we're the lay of the land that time of year. But I mean, they're in five competitions as we speak. It's for this season, and I don't know when they would have done it. They would have been catching up fixtures until August. I mean, it's just not going to happen. So I suppose he has to balance it with that. But I suspect there will be some frustration that they're being told to play on. I think that certainly within that group, there will be some players and managers who will be desperate for a circuit breaker. Some of them have expressed it publicly already. Thomas Frank has already said it.
I think a lot of managers are concerned about the fact they've basically got three games in 5 days with a vastly reduced squad. And that, you know, I think particularly, you know, Klopp, I know some people have looked at his comments the last few days saying, oh, he's only talking because it's bad for him and, you know, he's vested interests, all that sort of same argument as we had at the start of the pandemic. And there's probably an element of that. But he's also been pretty consistent over the last couple of years around players being overplayed, the risk to player welfare, about the burden and load of games. And I think we will see some pretty shambolic situations come about in that second and third phase of the festive period, because you're going to now have players mixing with their families around Christmas. There aren't that many rules, are there, really, around people actually flying into the UK. So I'm sure some players will have visitors from abroad for the festive period. The players aren't bubbling up in hotels or anything like that. And all the information from the government is that cases are on the rise. So there's only going to be more disruption, you would think, over the next few games. And that means squads are going to be stretched. And that means you're going to have certain players having to play a hell of a lot of football in a short space of time. So, let's talk about the transfers because it sounds more fun.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
Which little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
Are Leeds going to sign anyone then, Phil?
I think they're going to have to. I mean, they're notorious, really, I'd say notorious. They are in the habit of avoiding the January window. They don't like it financially. They don't think it's great value for money. Bielsa doesn't think you can pick up players who are up to speed for him, particularly ready. And the players who would be ready tend to be extremely, extremely expensive. But they've kind of reached the point where there's no alternative, I don't think. I mean, Adam was right what he's saying about the squad size at Leeds. Bielsa's always ridden with a very small squad. And it's worked for him for 3 years. But I think the fact that it's worked for 3 years doesn't mean that it's working now. And certainly injuries have put more pressure on this season than ever before. The one thing I would say in his defence with regards to this weekend just gone is that I think even with a bigger squad, they would have seriously felt the pinch because of the number of players who are missing. But it's the midfield more than anything where they've been light. It was the midfield where they tried to get Conor Gallagher from Chelsea in the summer, also looked at Lewis O'Brien from Huddersfield. And even going back to the previous summer window, they came very close to getting Michael Cuisance from Bayern Munich. That fell through because of an issue with his medical. So they have been looking in that area anyway, but they've got Phillips out until probably February, Liam Cooper the same. They've got plenty of other players, you know, Bamford, Struijk, injured as well. They've got to pad this out. It's not to say that they might not have the legs anyway to stay up because there are clearly clubs below them who are in trouble as well. But I think on this particular occasion, it would be a very, very big risk to go through January and do nothing.
A Leeds fan who I was talking to last night mentioned Lewis O'Brien again, but also his wider point was if they're going to sign players, then they're going to have to sign players who are playing week in, week out at the moment because their fitness might be roughly near what Bielsa requires rather than going to other Premier League clubs and picking out one of their, you know, subs or reserves or whatever. They need players who are match fit now and ready to go, which means they might be looking in a slightly lower end market than maybe Leeds fans would like. No, I don't mean that disrespectfully to Lewis O'Brien and the Championship, but...
No, but you're right. And there'll be budget reasons for that as well. I don't think there'll be a massive amount of money at Leeds. I don't think they could go particularly big in this window. But if you look back to the signing they made 6 months before they were promoted, Jean-Kevin Augustin from RB Leipzig, he hadn't played a huge amount of football. He'd been at Monaco, but he'd been on loan and he'd been in and out. It all kind of come to an end for him at Leipzig. And Leeds took him on loan with an obligation to sign him for £80 million if they went up. And that's still being processed by the Court of Arbitration for Sport because Leeds pulled out of that signing. Leipzig think they should have gone through with it. Somebody in early next year is going to get stung for money one way or the other. But the issue with Augustin was that he just wasn't up to Bielsa's levels of training or fitness. So in the end, he played, I think it was in total 43 minutes. And that's more than anything this time round, what they have to avoid is anybody arriving who takes a month and a half to get ready, because by that point they'll be into March and almost at the end of the season. So I agree with you. It needs to be players who can play straight away, which makes me wonder if the loan market might be an option for them. I almost feel like they need to think in a bit more of a short-term way. I know pragmatism is not something you generally apply to Bielsa as a rule, but perhaps be a bit more pragmatic about what they're open to, who they might take and who, even in a short period of time, might just help them, you know, have the legs to get far enough ahead of the bottom three and to make sure that they don't go down, because they cannot afford that.
Chelsea can't bring someone like Conor Gallagher back. They don't have a recall, do they, Dom?
Well, they did have a recall, but he's played 50% of the games that he was available for Crystal Palace, so that, therefore that clause is null and void. Same with Billy Gilmore at Norwich City, I believe. So they don't have those options. In all honesty, I think that they're... The hope is that their midfield personnel are returning to fitness now, so they should be okay in that area. The area that is a concern still is left wing back, where they will assess Ben Chilwell's recovery from his knee ligament injury at the beginning of January to see whether he needs surgery or not. If it's surgery, then he's out for the season. If not, then presumably he'll be available by the end of the transfer window, and they'll probably just muddle on through. But you know, there has, given that Marcus Alonso is a very different kind of player, we're drawn to the attacking side of Alonso's game, but he's actually a lot slower on the pitch than Ben Chilwell is. And that's provided a bit of an imbalance to Chelsea's attacking play in recent weeks. They have really missed Chilwell, because when Chilwell and Reece James were going at defences, it was the nearest thing you'll get to Andy Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold doing what they did for Liverpool. So that they will look at that, and they will make a judgment on that. But again, I can't see them spending massive money in January, because I don't think the personnel will be out there. A lot of clubs will be very resistant to losing players in January, not least because they'll need bigger squads to cope with the pandemic.
David Ornstein reporting that Jesse Lingard's going to stay put at Manchester United. We might as well end with some United cynicism, shall we, Adam? So they're going to lose two players on a free in the summer.
Lingard and Pogba, if Paul Pogba doesn't sign a new contract. Yeah, and also they can't even get rid of players now that certain fans might want them to get rid of. Definitely not us, but I think players that they may have thought, oh, we could get a bit of money for him in January, they may now be thinking we need to keep players around because of the pandemic, and the squad's decimated, and we need to keep the squad as big as possible, which is quite, I think it's going to be a challenge as well for those clubs such as, you know, whether it's Leeds or Newcastle or whoever's spending down the bottom of the table, who thought, oh, maybe we can just get him on loan for 6 months from one of the bigger clubs. I think they're probably going to be having to look abroad now. But then again, even clubs abroad will be loath to lose players, but then maybe clubs will be more stretched financially as well, that can be exploited, because, you know, they'll be concerned about match day income. You know, Germany's gone already, hasn't it, in terms of reducing in certain grounds the attendances as well. But I don't think Manchester United will do that much in January unless a central midfielder comes available that Ralf Rangnick would really want.
Let's end with a highlight of 2021 then, football, not anything else has been going on. Your personal football highlight of 2021. You go first, Dom.
Oh, I'm going to go a bit sentimental here, I'm afraid. But no one else is going to suggest that Crystal Palace 1, Newcastle United 1 was a highlight for them, I doubt. But that was the first game I'd taken my 12-year-old to since fans came back into the stadium, and he missed 18 months. And when you're 11 or 12 years old, that's quite a big proportion of your life when you haven't been going to football matches. So to be able to do that, to be able to watch a game with a full Selhurst Park, watching it from the Arthur Waite stand as a fan, to celebrate a goal from your own team, but also just to look at the delight on his face when Callum Wilson scored an overhead kick, because, you know, all 12-year-olds love scoring bicycle kicks and overhead kicks. So to see him sort of turn around and say, wow, that was a good goal, even scored by the opposition, that just made my day. I'm desperately, desperately, desperately hoping that we get to keep fans in stadium for as long as possible, because, you know, times like that are pretty priceless.
I think if I'd have been asked to guess your personal highlight, I could have been here for a long time coming up with Palace 1, Newcastle 1. By the way, the Athletic's best of 2021 is published today, so you can read that on the Athletic. Go on, Phil.
I didn't get to go to this game, actually, because I was off work at the time, but I think it was the stars aligning so that Pablo Hernandez got a send-off from a crowd of sorts at Elland Roads on the last game of last season. I mean, he has been, I think, without question, the best signing in 20 years at Leeds, and definitely the player I've most enjoyed writing about and most enjoyed watching. I think Rafinha's going to run him close at this rate. But he didn't play much last season. There were issues between him and Bielsa. It was all kind of heading for a sort of tepid and quiet end, which would have been a travesty, really, on the basis of his performances. So nice for him, even though it was only 8,000 in Elland Road. Nice for him to get a proper farewell, I thought.
Good stuff. And Adam?
England 2, Germany 0 was incredible, just in terms of, you know, being able to be with people watching that game was really great. Thomas Muller's miss, Harry Kane's goal, Gareth Southgate looking so happy, the belief we might actually win it at that point. I think that was probably the high point.
We will end it there. Thank you. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
And to you.
And to you. That's it. Thanks very much for listening. You can subscribe to The Athletic now and get a 33% discount by heading to theathletic.com/footballpod. So you'll be able to read The Athletic's Best of 2021 if you do that. And then Dan and Flo will have their usual show tomorrow. I'll be back in the new year. Have a happy and hopefully safe Christmas. Bye-bye.
The Athletic.